Imagine lending a company $1 million, watching them go, completely bankrupt, and then finding out the law legally requires you to stand at the very back of the line while other people get paid out with the remnants of your money. I mean, welcome to the brutal reality of corporate liquidation.
Yeah, it is a harsh wake-up call for investors who don't actually read the fine print on their security agreements.
Oh, absolutely brutal. But hey, before we unpack all of this, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com. Okay, so let's get into it. You know, when you're staring down a massive professional licensing exam like the Series 65, it is incredibly easy to get just completely lost in the weeds.
Oh, entirely.
Right. Like you're memorizing flashcards, you're staring at definitions, and suddenly you feel like you were just swimming in this giant bowl of alphabet soup.
And see, that is precisely where test takers fail. The sheer volume of information can be overwhelming if you don't have like a framework to attach it to. Because the exam writers aren't looking to see if you can recite a dictionary definition.
No, not at all.
They're testing if you actually understand the structural mechanics of the financial system.
Which is exactly our mission for you today. Mm. We are building that framework, specifically zeroing in on the investment risk section of the exam. Depending on the draw you get on test day, this accounts for roughly 6 questions, or about 5% of your entire exam.
A very crucial 5%.
Exactly. Now, rote memorization is boring, and honestly, under the stress of a timed exam, it completely fails you. We want you to understand the why. Why do these rules exist? How do they interact mathematically? Because when you understand those underlying mechanics, you can navigate, any trick question they throw at you.
You won't just recognize the right answer. You'll be able to deconstruct exactly why the other three are, frankly, mathematical impossibilities.
Right.
But to achieve that, we really have to start at the absolute bedrock. If there is a fundamental law of physics in the investment universe, it's the risk-return trade-off. It's like the invisible gravity that pulls on every single financial instrument we are going to discuss today.
Okay, let's map this out. I've always heard higher risk equals higher reward. But I don't know, that phrase always feels a bit incomplete to me. It implies that if I just go out and do something totally reckless with my portfolio, the market is somehow obligated to hand me a giant bag of cash.
Yeah. That is a very dangerous misconception. The market does not reward you for taking blind, uncompensated risk. The actual rule is that higher risk generally demands a higher expected return.
Expected being the key word there.
Exactly. Expected. If an investor wants to achieve a greater potential return on their capital, they just must be willing to accept a mathematically higher degree of uncertainty regarding that outcome.
Okay, let me try an analogy here because I want to get away from just talking about like feelings of risk and get into the actual mechanics. Think about this like a spicy food challenge.
Okay, I like where this is going.
Right. Let's say you're at a restaurant. A treasury bill is basically a bell pepper. There is zero risk of pain. You eat it, you're totally fine, but you also get zero bragging rights, which is your return. No one cares that you ate a bell pepper.
Right. The yield is incredibly low because the risk of, well, gastric distress is virtually zero.
Exactly. But then you look at speculative stocks. That's the ghost pepper. If you eat the ghost pepper, you are taking on massive, almost guaranteed pain and volatility. So to even consider putting that in your mouth, you demand a huge potential payout, massive bragging rights, a t-shirt, your picture on the wall.
That is a remarkably accurate way to look at financial markets. Investors are essentially demanding a premium for enduring the heat. When they buy U.S. Treasury bills, the bell pepper, they know the U.S. government has the power to tax and print money.
The ultimate antacid.
Basically, yeah. The risk of default is virtually zero. Therefore, the investor accepts a very low premium, a low yield, a low expected return.
But if they invest in a wild speculative startup, they are eating the ghost pepper. They demand a massive potential payout to justify the incredibly high probability that their capital will just be completely wiped out.
Right. So tethering those two concepts together is vital.
Okay, so listener, I want to pause and ask you a direct question.
Mm.
I want you to really think about the mechanics of this for a second. If you are looking at a prospectus, or maybe a friend pitches you a new investment, and it is offering a 20% guaranteed return, what should your brain immediately tell you based on the physics of the market? Take a beat.
Your brain should absolutely be setting off alarm bells that this investment is hiding a massive amount of structural risk.
Massive.
Risk and expected return are tethered together. If the return is sky high, the risk must be equally high, regardless of what the marketing brochure claims. If it says guaranteed at 20%, it just defies the fundamental laws of finance.
It's either a Ponzi scheme, or there is some fine print that is going to absolutely destroy you. The market doesn't hand out 20% yields to people taking zero risk. All right, so we've got the foundational rule. Capital demands a premium based on the probability of loss. Now, let's step into the corporate world and look at how this actually plays out when a company needs money to grow. Let's introduce a recurring character. Let's call him Frank the founder.
Okay, let's look at Frank's balance sheet.
So Frank is ambitious, a little reckless, and he has started a company that manufactures rocket-powered roller skates. Let's call the company Frank's Fission-Powered Freewheelers.
A product line that clearly carries some inherent liability and massive capital requirements.
Oh, massive. You don't just build rocket skates in a garage, right? Frank needs a state-of-the-art factory, a literal ton of aerospace-grade titanium, and a whole team of propulsion engineers. That requires cash. Millions of dollars.
So Frank has to figure out his capital structure.
Which is the fundamental mix of how a company finances its operations. Right. And he basically has two main doors he can walk through to get that cash. Debt and equity.
Let's examine the mechanics of door number one, debt financing. If Frank chooses this route, he's going to a bank for a loan, or he is issuing corporate bonds to investors.
Okay, so if I buy Frank's bonds, I am handing him my cash. What is the legal relationship we just created there? I don't own the company now, do I?
No, absolutely not. You have created a creditor relationship. When Frank uses debt financing, he is simply borrowing money. He is making a legally binding promise to pay back your principal amount plus a fixed amount of interest on a very specific contractual schedule.
So I'm just a lender.
You are a creditor. If Frank's rocket skates become a global phenomenon and the company makes $1 trillion, your bond still only pays the, say, 5% interest you initially agreed upon. You do not get to share in the upside profit.
Which, I mean, feels like a bad deal until you remember the spicy food analogy. I accepted a capped return because I also have a legal guarantee to get paid before the owners do if things go wrong. We'll get to that in a second. But first, let's look at door number two, equity.
Right. Equity financing changes the legal dynamic entirely. Mm-hmm. If Frank walks through this door, he is issuing stock. He is selling fractional pieces of his company.
So the people who buy that stock are the owners. They hold the equity.
Correct. They are buying a slice of the pie. And unlike the creditors, these equity holders do not get guaranteed interest payments. There's no contractual schedule saying Frank has to pay them back.
Oh.
But because they took on that massive uncertainty, because they're holding the bag if the company fails, they own the upside.
Right.
If Frank's fission-powered freewheelers takes over the world, their slice of the pie becomes astronomically valuable.
Okay, so we have creditors on one side, creating upside for legal protection. We have owners on the other side, trading protection for unlimited upside potential. Now, let's fast forward 2 years. Shockingly, the market for strapping literal rockets to your feet isn't quite as robust as Frank projected in his pitch deck.
Mostly because his early adopters keep breaking the sound barrier and crashing into brick walls, I assume.
Exactly. The liability lawsuits pile up, the cash burn rate exceeds their revenue, and the company experiences what we call a liquidity crisis.
That's just the polite financial way of saying Frank is completely broke, he defaults on his loans, the company files for bankruptcy, and it goes into liquidation. It is over.
It's done. Which brings us to one of the most heavily tested critical frameworks on the Series 65, the liquidation priority. When a corporate entity dies, the bankruptcy courts step in. Their job is to take all the remaining assets, the factory, the leftover titanium, the intellectual property, the office furniture, and liquidate them, sell them for cash. Then the court distributes that cash to the people Frank owes money to.
And they don't just toss the cash into a crowd and see who catches it. There is a rigid, unbending line that forms outside the bankruptcy courthouse.
The corporate ladder of doom.
It is officially known as the absolute priority rule. If you want to pass this exam, you must burn this rule into your memory. Creditors are paid before equity holders, always. Under every circumstance, debt comes before ownership. If you own a piece of the company, you are at the back of the line.
Okay, let's build this ladder of doom, the line outside the courthouse. There are 5 main steps on this ladder, and the exam will test you on the exact order. Priority number 1, the very first people in line to get paid from the sale of Frank's assets. Who are they?
The absolute top of the ladder is secured debt. These are the creditors who refuse to just take Frank's word for it. When they originally lent him the money, they demanded collateral to mitigate their risk.
I just picture these folks showing up to the factory with heavy metal chains and padlocks, like they hold a mortgage on the actual real estate, or they hold an equipment trust certificate on the titanium manufacturing machines.
That is the exact mechanism. Because their loan is backed by a specific physical liquidatable asset, they have the highest claim. Let's say Frank owes them $2 million. The bankruptcy court sells the factory for $2 million. Those secured bondholders get that entire $2 million before anyone else sees a single penny.
But let's tie this back to our foundational rule of risk and return. Because these secured creditors have the absolute lowest risk of losing their money, because they literally hold the padlock. What does that mean for their return?
It means they accepted the lowest expected return when they initially bought the bonds. They demanded a very low yield. Lowest risk, lowest return, first in line at the courthouse.
Okay, the factory is sold, the secured creditors are made whole, and they go home happy. We step down to priority number two. Who is next?
Priority two belongs to unsecured debt. In the corporate bond market, these are formally known as debentures.
Debentures. It's a word you only hear in finance. I always thought it sounded like a set of fake teeth, but it's really just a bond without a padlock.
Pretty much. A debenture is simply a debt obligation backed only by the general creditworthiness and earning power of the issuer, not by any specific collateral. These investors lent Frank money based purely on his business plan and his good word.
So if they don't have a claim on the factory, what are they getting paid out of?
They get paid out of whatever cash is generated from selling the unpledged assets, the extra office chairs, the company cars, maybe some remaining inventory. But notice the mechanics here. They took on significantly more risk than the secured creditors. They didn't have a physical asset to fall back on.
Which means to entice them to lend him money without collateral, Frank had to offer them a higher interest rate, right? Higher risk, higher yield. They are second in line. All right, moving down to priority number three. The line is getting longer and the cash is definitely getting thinner.
Priority three is subordinated debt.
Now, wait a minute. The outline says subordinated debt is just another type of debenture. It's unsecured. So why are they a whole separate step down the ladder?
Because of the specific legal contract they signed. When these investors bought their bonds, they signed an indenture agreement explicitly stating that in the event of liquidation, their claims would be subordinated, meaning legally placed below the claims of the regular unsecured debenture holders.
Hold on. I need to put myself in the shoes of an investor here. Why on earth would I ever voluntarily sign a contract that says, sure, Frank, I'll lend you $1 million, and if you go broke, I volunteer to wait in line behind all those other unsecured guys. That sounds insane.
It sounds insane until you look at the yield. They do it for the premium. Because they contractually agreed to take on more risk by stepping to the back of the creditor line, Frank had to compensate them heavily. Subordinated debt, which is often called mezzanine financing in the private markets, carries a much higher interest rate than regular senior debt.
Oh.
Sometimes it even comes with equity kickers like warrants, just to sweeten the deal. They chased the yield, and they accepted the structural risk.
It's the ghost pepper again. They wanted the massive premium, so they agreed to stand in the danger zone. Okay, so we've covered secured debt, unsecured debt, and subordinated debt. Those are all creditors. They all walk through door number one. Let's say all the creditors are now completely paid off. Who is standing at priority number four?
Now we cross the critical threshold from the creditors to the owners. Priority four is preferred stock. This is equity.
Equity with a VIP pass.
Exact. Preferred stockholders are owners, not lenders. They don't have a guaranteed maturity date where they get their principal back. However, they hold a preference over regular common stockholders. While the company is operating, they have priority for receiving dividends. And in a liquidation, they get paid out before the common stock.
But, and listener, this is the massive blinking neon sign you need to pay attention to. They are still equity.
They are equity, which means they stand behind every single creditor.
Let me push on this to make sure the mechanics are crystal clear. You are telling me that the guy holding the subordinated debt, the guy who literally signed a contract, volunteering to be the absolute lowest, riskiest priority creditor, he still gets paid before the preferred stockholder.
Without question, the absolute most junior, riskiest debenture holder possesses a senior legal claim over the highest, most elite class of preferred stock. The absolute priority rule does not bend. Debt always beats equity. The creditors must be made 100% whole before a single cent flows to the equity side of the line.
Which brings us to the very bottom of the ladder. Priority number five, the scavengers.
Common stock, in a bankruptcy, they hold what is called a residual claim.
Residual meaning whatever's left over after everyone else has had their fill.
Correct. After the secured lenders take the real estate, the unsecured lenders take the inventory, the subordinated lenders take the office furniture, and the preferred stockholders take whatever loose change is left in the couch cushions, the common stockholders get what remains.
And structurally speaking, when a company like Frank's fission-powered freewheelers undergoes a Chapter 7 liquidation, what is usually left over for the common stockholders?
Mathematically, zero. The cash almost always runs out long before the court reaches the common equity tier. This is why common stock represents the highest structural risk in the entire capital structure.
But let's flip the coin. If Frank's company hadn't exploded, if rocket skates became the new standard mode of global transportation, the secured bondholder still just gets their boring 5% interest. But the common stockholder, they own the explosive growth. They are the ones who become billionaires. Unlimited upside, maximum risk of total loss.
And that is the absolute essence of equity ownership.
Okay, let's stop right here. Pattern interrupt. Listener, I'm about to lay out a classic exam trap that catches thousands of test takers every year. It is what I call the adjectives trap. Imagine you were staring at a multiple choice question. Frank's company goes bankrupt. The exam asks you to rank who gets paid first. One of the options is a security called a super senior prior lien preferred stock. Another option is a junior subordinated debenture. Now, human psychology sees the words super senior and prior lien and thinks, wow, that sounds incredibly safe and important. And it sees junior subordinated and thinks, well, that sounds like a total loser.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't the super senior preferred stock jump ahead of the junior debenture?
It absolutely does not. This is where the exam writers are deliberately trying to manipulate your perception using vocabulary. Adjectives do not rewrite bankruptcy law.
So super senior means nothing.
I mean, it means something, but only within its own specific class. A senior preferred stock just means it has priority over a junior preferred stock. But it is still preferred stock. It is still equity. The word lien or senior cannot magically transform equity into debt. The junior subordinated debenture, despite its terrible sounding name, is a creditor. It is debt. Debt beats equity, period. Do not let fancy adjectives trick you into crossing the absolute priority line.
Okay, listener, let's solidify this. Direct question for you. Think before you answer. The exam asks, which of the following security holders assumes the least amount of risk in a corporate bankruptcy? Your choices are A, cumulative preferred stockholders, or B, secured bondholders. What is your answer? Give it a second.
The answer must be the secured bondholders. They have the least risk because they sit at priority number one. They have a physical claim on an asset. The test tries to distract you with the word cumulative on the preferred stock, making it sound protected, but it's still equity sitting way down at step four. Lowest risk equals top of the ladder.
Brilliant. All right, so Frank's company went belly up in a spectacular fireball. Watching this entire disaster unfold from the sidelines is our second recurring character. Let's introduce Cautious Kathy.
Kathy represents a very specific risk-averse investor profile.
Kathy watched Frank's investors lose everything, and she is terrified. She says, you know what? I'm not buying secured debt. I'm not buying unsecured debt. I am certainly not touching equity. I have $10,000 in savings, and I am putting it in a 0% checking account. Or better yet, I'm just stuffing it inside my mattress. I want absolutely zero risk.
It's a natural psychological reaction to witnessing market carnage. But Kathy is falling victim to an illusion. She thinks she has eliminated risk, but she has actually just traded a loud, obvious risk for a silent, invisible one. By choosing to hold cash, she is incurring massive opportunity cost.
The silent killer of wealth. Let's dive into the mechanics of this, because opportunity cost isn't just a philosophical idea. It's a testable economic principle. What exactly is it?
Opportunity cost is defined as the potential economic benefit that an investor forfeits when they choose one alternative over another. It is the mathematical return you could have earned on the next best available option.
Let's put numbers to it with Kathy. She has her 10 grand zipped up inside her mattress. She feels safe. But meanwhile, outside her bedroom window, the economy is booming. The S&P 500 goes on a tear and returns 20% for the year. What is Kathy's opportunity cost?
Her opportunity cost is the 20% gain, the $2,000 that she missed out on. By prioritizing the perceived absolute safety of the mattress, she made an active decision to forfeit the growth occurring in the equity market.
Now, this is exactly where the Series 65 tries to twist your brain. Did Cautious Kathy actually lose any money?
In nominal absolute dollar terms, no. She put $10,000 into the mattress on January 1st, and on December 31st, She unzips it and pulls out exactly $10,000. Her account balance did not decline.
And that is the gotcha. The exam will set up a scenario where an investor didn't lose a single dime in direct out-of-pocket financial loss, and then it will ask if they suffered a cost. Opportunity cost is an implicit cost. It is a foregone gain. You have to train your brain to recognize that just because the balance didn't drop doesn't mean a massive cost wasn't paid.
And this concept applies to every single financial decision, not just holding cash. If you allocate your portfolio heavily into government bonds, your opportunity cost is the potentially much higher return of large cap stocks. If you go all in on tech stocks, your opportunity cost is the guaranteed income and stability you would have had from bonds during a market correction. Every choice casts a shadow.
Let's walk Kathy through another scenario, because this highlights another classic exam trap. Let's call it the bond trap. Kathy realizes the mattress is a bad idea. She wants a little bit of yield, but she is still too scared to buy stocks. She looks at the bond market. She finds a highly rated 10-year corporate bond from a very stable company paying a fixed 4% interest rate. She takes her $10,000 and buys that bond. She locks it in.
From her perspective, she has secured a safe, predictable cash flow for the next decade.
Right. But a month later, the macroeconomic weather shifts dramatically. The central bank raises rates. Suddenly, brand new 10-year bonds from that exact same stable company are being issued to the public. But now they're paying a 6% interest rate. What just happened to Kathy?
Kathy is now trapped in an inferior asset, and she is bleeding opportunity cost. She is legally contracted to receive a 4% yield for the next 10 years. But the next best alternative, which is simply taking $10,000 and buying a new bond today, yields 6%.
Let's do the math on that. At 4%, she makes $400 a year. At 6%, she would be making $600 a year. She is missing out on $200 every single year for a decade. That's $2,000 of lost potential income.
Exactly. She didn't lose her principal. The company is still faithfully paying her the $400 they promised, but she is suffering the massive opportunity cost of having her capital locked in a suboptimal position while the rest of the market moved on to better yields.
This perfectly illustrates why avoiding volatility by seeking safety often just exposes you to different, less obvious types of risk you can't hide.
Which brings us to the core realization every investor must make the moment you deploy capital. The moment you step out of your house and into the market, you are exposed to the weather.
Macroeconomic weather, yes. In finance, this is called systematic risk.
Systematic risk is arguably the most dominant force in portfolio management. It represents the broad overarching market forces, economic shifts, or global geopolitical events that drag down the value of investments across the board, regardless of how fundamentally sound any individual company might be.
I want to make this tangible. It doesn't matter if you own one stock, 10 stocks, or the 1,000 stocks. If it starts raining and you are outside, you are getting wet. Systematic risk is the rain. And here is the absolute most critical point for the exam, listeners, so lock this in. Systematic risk cannot be diversified away.
That is the defining boundary. You cannot outrun a systemic storm by just buying more houses in the same neighborhood. If the entire global economy contracts, buying 500 different stocks instead of 50 will not save your portfolio from dropping.
Okay, so we need a reliable way to memorize the big systematic risks that the Theory 65 specifically tests. And there's a phenomenal acronym for this. It's PRIME, P-R-I-M-E. Let's break this down letter by letter.
PRIME is the standard mnemonic. Let's begin with P, purchasing power risk. This is almost exclusively referred to in the real world as inflation risk.
Okay, let's look at the mechanics of inflation risk. This is the risk that your money simply won't buy as much physical stuff in the future. Let's go back to cautious Kathy. She is holding that bond, paying her 4%. She feels good. She's making 4% a year. But what happens if inflation, the cost of groceries, gas, housing is running at 5%?
We have to look at the difference between nominal return and real return. Her nominal return, the numbers on her brokerage statement, is positive 4%. But her real return, adjusted for the purchasing power of those dollars, is negative 1%.
She is actually getting poorer every single day, even though her investment is technically making money.
Precisely. Because inflation affects the entire macroeconomic landscape, eroding the value of currency across the board, it is a systematic risk.
All right. Next letter in PRIME is R.
R stands for reinvestment risk. We actually caught a glimpse of this earlier, but let's reverse the scenario. Imagine Kathy bought a fantastic bond a few years ago that was paying 8%. She was thrilled. But today, that bond reaches maturity. The company hands her back her $10,000 principal.
She wants to keep the party going, so she goes back to the market to buy a new bond with that $10,000.
But the macroeconomic weather has changed. The central banks slashed rates to stimulate the economy. Prevailing interest rates have plummeted to 3%. Kathy can no longer find a safe 8% yield anywhere. She is forced to reinvest her return principal in a much lower yielding environment, severely reducing her ongoing cash flow.
The weather changed, and she has to settle for less. She didn't do anything wrong. The market just shifted beneath her feet. Get ready for the big one, the I'm in prime.
Interest rate risk. If there is one systematic concept you will be tested on heavily, it is this. Interest rate risk is the risk that fluctuations in broad interest rates will inversely affect the value of fixed income securities.
We need to spend some serious time here because this is a mechanical mathematical concept that trips people up. There is an absolute unbending inverse relationship here. It's a seesaw.
It is a seesaw. When prevailing interest rates go up, the market prices of existing bonds go down. When prevailing interest rates go down, existing bond prices go up.
Let's explain the why. Listener, I want you to visualize the math here because if you memorize the rule without understanding the mechanism, a tricky question will break you. Let's go back to Kathy. She has a bond paying 5%. Let's say she paid $1,000 for it, so it pays her $50 a year. Suddenly, the central bank raises rates. New bonds issued today by the exact same company are paying 7%. That's $70 a year.
Now imagine Kathy suddenly needs cash to buy a house, so she tries to sell her 5% bond in the secondary market. She approaches another investor and says, hey, will you buy my bond for the $1,000 I paid for it? It pays $50 a year.
And what does that investor say? They laugh her out of the room. Why on earth would they hand her $1,000 to get a $50 cash flow when they could just call their broker, hand them $1,000, and get a brand new bond paying a $70 cash flow? They wouldn't do it.
They wouldn't. Kathy's 5% bond is now an inferior, suboptimal product in a 7% world. The only way Kathy can convince that investor to buy her bond is if she puts it on clearance. She has to lower the price she is asking.
Let's do the math on the clearance rack. If the new market standard is a 7% yield, the investor wants to earn 7% on whatever money they hand Kathy. Since Kathy's bond only kicks out $50 a year, we have to figure out what price makes $50 look like a 7% return. You divide $50 by 7 for 7 tenths.
Which comes out to roughly $714.
Boom. Right there. Kathy has to drop the price of her bond from $1,000 down to $714. If the investor buys it for $714 and gets $50 a year, they are effectively earning a 7% yield on their money, which matches the new market rate. That is the mechanical, mathematical reason why rising rates force existing bond prices down. It is just gravity.
It forces the price to discount until the yield to maturity matches the current market environment.
Now, here is the massive exam gotcha regarding interest rate risk. The test will give you a list of four different bonds with different traits, and it will ask you, which of these bonds is the most sensitive to a change in interest rates? Meaning, which one's price will swing the most violently? How do we solve that?
You are looking for a combination of two specific characteristics, maturity length and coupon rate. The golden rule is, the longest maturity and the lowest coupon rate will always exhibit the greatest price volatility in response to interest rate changes.
Longest maturity, lowest coupon. Let's break those down, starting with maturity. I like to think of a bond maturity like signing a cell phone contract. Imagine you find a 10-year cell phone contract today, locking in a price of $100 a month for basic slow data. You are locked in for a full decade.
A truly terrifying financial prospect.
The stuff of nightmares, right? Now, 1 year later, a massive technological breakthrough happens. 6G data is everywhere. Suddenly, every cell carrier is offering unlimited lightning-fast data for $20 a month. But you are trapped in your 10-year contract paying $100 for garbage data.
The duration of your commitment amplifies your pain.
Exactly. Mm. The longer your contract, the longer your maturity, the more pain you suffer when the market rates change against you. Yeah. If you had only signed a 1-year contract, it wouldn't be a big deal. You just wait a few months, let it expire, and sign up for the new cheap rate.
That maps perfectly to bond duration. A bond with a 30-year maturity is locking up your principal for 3 decades.
Wow. Yeah.
And if interest rates spike next year, you are stuck holding a subpar yield for 29 more years. The market punishes that severe lack of flexibility heavily, so the price of that 30-year bond will plummet far more severely than the price of a short-term 2-year bond.
Okay, so long maturity equals high sensitivity. What about the second half of the rule, the lowest coupon part? Why does a lower payout make a bond more volatile?
A lower coupon means the bond is paying you less cash flow along the way. If you aren't receiving significant cash flow in the near term, it means a much greater portion of your total investment return is heavily reliant on receiving that massive final principal payment decades in the future. Because the bulk of your return is pushed so far out into the future, the present value of that bond is much more mathematically sensitive to changes in the current discount rate.
Let me push this to the absolute extreme to see if the logic holds up. What if I have a bond that pays literally zero interest along the way? A zero coupon bond. I just buy it for $500 today, get no cash for 20 years, and then they hand me $1,000 at the end.
By the laws of the math we just discussed, because it has the lowest possible coupon ZIO, it will be the most volatile fixed income security on the market. Zero coupon bonds experience massive, violent price swings when interest rates change because 100% of their return is locked at the maturity date.
Okay, listener, lock this in your brain for test day. If they ask which bond is most volatile, you scan the answers. First, find the one with the longest time until it matures. If two bonds tie for the longest maturity, look at the coupon and pick the one paying the lowest percentage. That is your answer every time. Points secured. Let's get back to our PRIME acronym. We covered purchasing power, reinvestment, and interest rate. What is M?
M stands for market risk. This is the risk that the overall stock market experiences a broad decline, dragging down the vast majority of securities regardless of their individual merit. When a major recession hits, or a black swan event occurs, institutional and retail investors panic and liquidate equities across the board.
The baby gets thrown out with the bathwater. Even companies with soaring profits, amazing management, and zero debt will see their stock prices plummet simply because they're swimming in a plunging market.
Exactly. It's the ultimate getting caught in the rain scenario.
And the final letter in PRIME, E.
E is exchange rate risk, also known as currency risk. This primarily affects international investments.
Walk me through the mechanics of this. How does currency movement wipe out my gains?
Let's say you invest in a fantastic manufacturing company in Japan. You buy their stock on the Tokyo Exchange, which means it is denominated in Japanese yen. You hold it for a year, the company crushes its earnings, and the stock price goes up 20%. Yeah. You are thrilled.
I made 20%. Time to celebrate.
Not quite. Because during that same year, the macroeconomic environment shifted and the value of the Japanese yen plummeted by 30% relative to the US dollar.
Oh, man.
So when you sell that stock and convert your yen back into US dollars to bring your money home, that currency devaluation mathematically wipes out your 20% start gain and you actually realize a net loss on the investment. The stock performed perfectly, but the systematic currency risk destroyed your return.
Okay, so that is PRIME. Purchasing power, reinvestment, interest rate, market exchange rate, all systematic, all unavoidable weather. You cannot diversify them away. Now, speaking of diversification, I want to introduce you to our third character. I want you to meet Diversification Dan.
Okay, let's examine Dan's portfolio strategy.
Dan thinks he has cracked the code. He read a blog post about risk, and he says, I am going to build the ultimate bulletproof, perfectly diversified portfolio. So Dan goes out. And he buys stock in an electric utility company in New York. Then he buys a water utility in California. Then a natural gas utility in Texas. He keeps doing this until he owns stock in 50 completely different utility companies across the entire country. He sits back, dusts his hands off, and says, I am a genius. I am diversified against any risk.
Dan is operating under a dangerous illusion.
Burst his bubble. What massive pothole did Dan completely miss?
Dan missed sector risk, which is another critical form of systematic risk highlighted on the Series 65 outline. Sector risk is the reality that an entire specific industry or economic sector can decline simultaneously due to macroeconomic conditions that target that industry.
So even though he owns 50 distinct, legally separate companies, they all fundamentally do the exact same thing.
Precisely. Owning 50 different utility stocks does not protect you if a macroeconomic event strikes the utility sector as a whole. Dan hasn't actually diversified his risk. He's just purchased 50 different tickets for the exact same voyage. If the ship hits an iceberg, all 50 tickets go down with it.
Okay, but let's dive into why a whole sector would sink simultaneously. And this brings us to one of the most specific, sneaky, heavily tested traps on the entire exam. Let's look at Dan's utility stocks. The exam loves to test the relationship between utility stocks and interest rates. What typically happens to utility stock prices when interest rates rise?
Historically, when interest rates rise significantly, utility stock prices fall.
No, wait a minute. Hold the phone. We spent 15 minutes doing deep math to explain that rising interest rates crush bond prices. We talked about the seesaw.
Right.
But utilities are stocks. They are equities. They aren't fixed income securities with maturity dates. Why on earth are utility stocks acting like bonds?
It is a fantastic question, and the answer lies in capital structure and leverage. Think about the fundamental nature of what a utility company does. They build nuclear power plants, massive hydroelectric dams, and string millions of miles of high-voltage transmission lines. These are astronomically expensive, capital-intensive infrastructure projects.
They need billions of dollars to build that stuff before they can sell a single kilowatt of electricity.
Exactly. And they do not just have billions in cash sitting in a checking account. They finance these projects by borrowing. Utility companies traditionally carry massive amounts of debt on their balance sheets. They are highly leveraged entities.
Okay, I see where this is going.
So when the macroeconomic weather changes, when the central bank raises interest rates, the cost of borrowing money shoots up globally.
Which means when the utility company needs to roll over its short-term debt or issue new bonds to fund a power plant expansion, their interest payments suddenly skyrocket.
Precisely. We call it a margin squeeze. Their borrowing costs double or triple, which directly eats into their profit margins. If profits drop, it threatens their ability to pay the high dividends that utility investors rely on. Institutional investors see this dynamic affecting the entire utility industry simultaneously, and they aggressively sell off the stocks. The whole sector declines.
That is fascinating. So, on the exam, if they ask why utility stocks drop when rates rise, it is not because they are fixed income. It is because they are highly leveraged, capital-intensive businesses whose borrowing costs just went through the roof. Sector risk in action. Okay, let's touch on one more systematic risk before we move on. Geopolitical risk.
Geopolitical risk refers to broad, earth-shaking global loans. Major wars, international sanctions, sweeping trade disputes between economic superpowers, or global pandemics. These events cause widespread panic and supply chain disruption that ripple through the entire global economy.
It's the biggest weather system of all. A war breaks out, and it doesn't matter if you own tech stocks, utility stocks, or European manufacturing stocks. Everything takes a hit. Now, how does the finance world actually measure how much a specific stock or fund is going to get blown around by this systematic market wind?
We quantify that volatility using a metric called beta. Beta measures an investment's sensitivity relative to the overall market. The broader market, usually represented by the S&P 500, is assigned a baseline beta of exactly 1.0.
Okay, so if I buy an index fund that perfectly tracks the S&P 500, its beta is 1.0.
Correct. It moves in lockstep. If the market goes up 10%, your fund goes up 10%. If the market drops 5%, your fund drops 5%. Now, if you buy a highly volatile speculative tech startup, it might have a beta of 1.5. This means statistically, it is 50% more volatile than the market. If the market drops 10%, that tech stock might plummet 15%.
But conversely, if I buy a stable, mature consumer staples company, like a company that makes toothpaste, it might have a beta of 0.5. It's less volatile. If the market drops 10%, the toothpaste company might only drop 5%. People still brush their teeth in a recession.
Exactly. But the critical takeaway here, the reason we're discussing beta in the context of systematic risk, is that no matter what the beta is, it is still tethered to the market's gravity. You can buy low beta stocks to make the ride less bumpy, but you are still on the roller coaster. You cannot diversify away systematic risk.
You can only mitigate it through asset allocation, like moving your money entirely out of equities and into cash or bonds, or through complex hedging strategies like buying put options. But simply buying a larger quantity of stocks will never cure it.
A vital distinction.
All right. Let's take a breath. We've survived the unavoidable weather of systematic risk. Now it is time to shift gears and talk about the avoidable potholes.
We are moving into unsystematic risk.
Right. If systematic risk is a giant thunderstorm that blankets the entire city, unsystematic risk is a massive pothole in the middle of your lane on the highway. You can absolutely hit it and blow out your tire, but you don't have to hit it. You can see it coming and steer around it.
And the steering wheel in this financial metaphor is diversification. Unsystematic risk is highly specific. It is isolated to a particular company, a specific management team, or a localized industry. Because it is isolated, you can mathematically reduce or even eliminate its impact on your overall portfolio by spreading your investments across many different uncorrelated companies and sectors.
Let's bring back Frank the founder to illustrate this. Let's say Frank dusted himself off from the Rocketscape bankruptcy, convinced some new investors to back him, and against all odds, he has started a brand new company. This time, he is manufacturing AI-powered toaster ovens. He issues some new corporate bonds to fund it. What is the first unsystematic pothole we have to worry about?
The most immediate and direct pothole is credit risk, which is frequently tested as default risk. This is the very specific localized risk that Frank's new toaster company fails to generate enough cash flow, and he misses his scheduled bond interest payments. Or worse, he can't return the principal at maturity. He defaults on his debt obligations.
Now, why is this classified as unsystematic? If Frank defaults on his bonds, does that mean Microsoft is suddenly going to default on its bonds?
No, it has absolutely zero bearing on Microsoft. Frank's failure is entirely isolated to Frank's balance sheet. If you, as an investor, own bonds in 50 different unrelated companies across various sectors, Frank's default might cause a tiny 2% blip in your portfolio, but the other 49 companies keep paying you your interest like clockwork. You steered around the pothole. You diversified the risk away.
And as a quick, heavily tested exam note, who is generally considered to have zero credit risk?
The U.S. federal government. U.S. Treasury securities are considered the benchmark for risk-free assets regarding default. Because, as we mentioned, the government possesses the ultimate authority to tax its citizens and print fiat currency to service its debts.
A nice superpower to have. Okay, moving to the next plot hole. Financial risk. Now, this sounds incredibly broad. All investing is financial. But it means something very specific in this test context, doesn't it?
It does. Financial risk refers specifically to a company's use of leverage. It is an analysis of how much debt they have taken on relative to their equity capital. It is entirely tied to the capital structure decisions we discussed in segment one.
Let's paint a picture to understand the mechanics here. Frank decides he wants to expand his AI toaster empire internationally, and he wants to do it fast. But he doesn't want to issue more stock because he doesn't want to dilute his ownership control. So instead of equity, he just borrows and borrows and borrows. He takes out massive bank loans. His debt to equity ratio goes through the roof.
By heavily leveraging his balance sheet, Frank has dramatically increased the company's financial risk. Let's look at the math of a margin squeeze. Because he borrowed so much, Frank now has massive fixed interest payments that he is legally obligated to make every single month, regardless of how many toasters he sells.
Let's put numbers on it. Let's say Frank's company brings in $100,000 a month in profit before debt. Because he leveraged to the moon, his mandatory monthly debt payment is $90,000. He is left with $10,000. He's surviving.
He is surviving, but he has zero margin for error. If a mild recession hits or a competitor launches a better toaster and Frank's sales dip by just 15%,
his profit drops to $85,000. But his debt payment is still legally fixed at $90,000. He is mathematically insolvent overnight. He is bleeding $5,000 a month. The debt structure crushed him.
Exactly. That is the mechanism of financial risk. The leverage amplified a small operational hiccup into a fatal bankruptcy.
And again, this is unsystematic. Frank's bad habit of borrowing too much money doesn't affect Apple's balance sheet. Now, how does that differ from the next unsystematic risk? Issuer-specific risk, which is also commonly called business risk.
This is a crucial distinction that trips up a lot of candidates. Financial risk is entirely about how the business is funded, the ratio of debt to equity. Business risk, or issuer-specific risk, is about what the business actually does. It is tied to their day-to-day operations, their management decisions, their product viability, and their competitive environment.
Okay, let's look at a scenario. Let's say Frank actually learned his lesson from the rocket skates. He operates his toaster company with absolutely zero debt. He only uses equity financing. His financial risk, by definition, is zero. He has no fixed interest payments. But unfortunately, his AI software has a glitch where the toasters occasionally become sentient and start launching flaming bagels across the kitchen.
Well, that's a significant product defect.
A massive liability. Word gets out on social media. Sales plummet to zero. There's a massive product recall and class action lawsuits are filed. The stock price crashes to pennies.
That is pure business risk. The company failed not because of its debt structure, it had none, but because its core operations and products were fundamentally flawed. This is vital for the exam. You can analyze a company and find it has excellent operations and low business risk, but it still goes bankrupt because of high financial risk from too much debt. Conversely, like Frank's sentient toasters, you can have a company with zero financial risk that fails entirely due to high business risk.
There are two distinct potholes. Both are unsystematic. And you avoid both of them by not putting all your life savings into Frank's volatile toaster company. All right, the fourth big unsystematic risk, legal or regulatory risk.
This is the risk that sudden changes in laws, regulations, or targeted government actions negatively affect a specific company or a specific localized industry.
For example, the Consumer Product Safety Commission steps in and completely bans the sale of AI toasters because of the Flaming Bagel incidents. Frank's entire business model is wiped out by the stroke of a bureaucratic pen overnight.
Precisely. Or consider a more common example. A new, strict environmental regulation is passed that severely impacts the profitability of domestic coal mining companies, forcing them to spend millions on new scrubbers. However, that same regulation leaves software companies or healthcare providers completely untouched. Because the risk targets a specific sector or issuer, it is isolated. It is unsystematic.
Okay, listener, perk your ears up.
Right.
Stop what you are doing and focus, because I am going to set up a side-by-side comparison for you. This is a massive test trap.
Yeah.
The exam writers know exactly how human brains misfile similar-sounding words, and they will exploit it. What is the difference between political risk and geopolitical risk? Take a second. Are they the same thing?
They're absolutely not the same thing, and confusing them will definitely cost you points. We discussed geopolitical risk earlier in the systematic section. Geopolitical refers to global macro events, a major world war, sweeping international sanctions, a global pandemic. It affects the whole world. Therefore, geopolitical risk is systematic. You cannot diversify it away.
But political risk?
Political risk is highly localized and specific. It refers to government actions or political instability within one specific sovereign nation. The classic textbook example used on exams is an emerging market nation suddenly deciding to nationalize its domestic oil industry, seizing the physical assets of foreign energy companies operating within its borders.
No, if I, as an investor, put all my money into oil rigs located in that one specific country, I just lost everything due to a targeted political decision.
Yes, a devastating localized loss. But could you have avoided that loss?
Yes, by using the steering wheel, diversification. If I owned oil rigs in Norway and Texas and Brazil and Canada, the nationalization in that one single emerging market country would only be a small, manageable hit to my total portfolio.
Exactly. Because you can diversify your exposure across multiple different countries and jurisdictions, political risk is classified as unsystematic. Geopolitical is systematic weather. Political is an unsystematic pothole. Memorize that boundary.
All right, I have one more direct question for you, the listener. Let's bring back diversification, Dan. Remember, Dan, he learned his lesson about utility stocks. He realized sector risk was a real thing. So Dan completely revamps his portfolio strategy. He goes out and he buys 200 different stocks. He buys tech stocks, healthcare stocks, consumer goods, financials, industrials, 200 distinct unrelated companies across every sector of the economy. Here is the two-part question. First, is Dan diversified? And second, does Dan have good asset allocation?
Let's break this down meticulously, because the exam will test your ability to differentiate these two concepts. First question, is Dan diversified? The answer is yes, he is highly diversified. By holding 200 different stocks across various unrelated sectors, Dan has effectively eliminated almost all of his unsystematic company-specific risk. If one of his healthcare stocks goes bankrupt because an FDA drug trial fails, it barely registers on his total portfolio balance.
He steered around the potholes perfectly. He is insulated from individual failures. But what about the second part of the question? Does he have good asset allocation?
The answer there is no, or at least his asset allocation is extremely aggressive and unbalanced. Asset allocation is the macro strategy of dividing your investment capital among different broad asset classes, specifically stocks, bonds, and cash equivalents. Dan is 100% invested in equities.
Which means
Dan is still fully 100% exposed to systematic market risk. When the next major macroeconomic recession hits or a geopolitical crisis occurs, the entire global stock market might drop 20%. Because Dan is entirely allocated in equities, his 200 perfectly diversified companies will all drop together. Diversification cured his unsystematic risk. But only asset allocation shifting a percentage of that equity money into fixed income bonds or cash could have managed his systematic risk.
That is a phenomenal distinction. Diversification handles the micro potholes. Asset allocation handles the macro weather. The exam will try to use those terms interchangeably in the question stems, but they are very different tools in the financial tool belt.
Absolutely. You must know which tool fixes which problem.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. We have deconstructed the mechanics of risk. Let's synthesize this. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute highest yield, most testable takeaways from this entire deep dive. Number one, the liquidation ladder.
The absolute priority rule dictates that debt always, always beats equity in a corporate liquidation. Secured bonds are first in line. Common stock is last. Do not fall for the adjectives trap. A super senior preferred stock still loses to a junior subordinated debenture. Debt beats equity.
Number two, opportunity cost.
It is not a realized, explicit financial loss that shows up on a statement. It is the invisible, implicit cost of a foregone gain. Choosing to lock your money into a safe 4% bond means accepting the mathematical opportunity cost of missing a 20% stock market rally.
Number three, the unavoidable weather.
Systematic risk cannot be diversified away. Remember the PRIME acronym: purchasing power, reinvestment, interest rate, market exchange rate. Also remember sector risk and global geopolitical risk. All of these affect the broad market, and their volatility is measured by beta.
Number four, the interest rate seesaw.
There is an inverse relationship. When prevailing interest rates go up, existing bond prices must go down to match the yield. And the most sensitive bonds, the ones that experience the most violent price drops, are the ones with the longest maturity and the lowest coupon rate, like a 30-year zero coupon bond.
And finally, number five, the potholes.
Unsystematic risks like credit default risk, financial leverage risk, issuer-specific business risk, and localized political risk can all be cured by diversification. But remember, diversification is not asset allocation. Diversification fixes unsystematic risk. Asset allocation is required to manage systematic risk.
Boom. That is your framework. You have the mechanics. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with a final thought to chew on, something that goes a little deeper into the philosophy of finance than just passing the test.
We spend so much time in modern portfolio theory trying to perfectly mitigate risk. We balance debt and equity. We obsess over calculating optimal asset allocation. We preach the gospel of diversification to eliminate every single drop of unsystematic, company-specific risk. But consider this dynamic. By systematically trying to eliminate all unsystematic risk in a portfolio, by diversifying so broadly across hundreds of stocks in every sector, are we unwittingly just guaranteeing that we suffer the exact same systematic market crashes as everyone else? If you diversify perfectly, you aren't really an active investor picking winners anymore. You have simply purchased the market average for better or for worse.
It makes you wonder if sometimes doing deep research, finding a few fundamentally incredible companies, and taking a concentrated bet isn't the craziest idea after all. You just have to be willing to underwrite the ghost pepper and eat the volatility. Congratulations on surviving this deep dive into investment risk. Take these concepts, keep the mechanics in your head, remember Frank and Kathy, and go crush those practice exams. We'll see you next time.